For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Today's morning show interview is from the archives. It was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2003. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we are turning our attention back to the year 1944. With the United States still locked in the Second World War, and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt deciding to campaign for an unprecedented fourth term as President of the United States. What the general public did not know, and as a matter of fact, what many people in the Roosevelt administration did not know, is that Roosevelt was a very, very sick man at this point in time, contending with horrific health difficulties. Nevertheless, he pressed on with the assistance of his personal physician, Dr. Ross McIntyre, and his cardiologist, Dr. Howard Brune, who became Roosevelt's primary physician during the last year of his life. The way in which FDR underwent this fourth and final presidential campaign, despite health woes, was of great interest to my morning show guest, Dr. Hugh Evans, who was 10 years old at the time. Dr. Evans, a medical doctor himself, has done extensive study of this, and the result is a fascinating book called The Hidden Campaign, FDR's Health and the 1944 Election, published by Routledge. I wanted to mention two books which I have read in the past, which are close to the topic, and I think that's one reason why I've had a personal interest in this particular slice of our history, and but I'm so grateful for your book taking this particular chapter and really diving in with even greater depth. One of the books I wanted to mention, which I assume, Dr. Evans, you're at least familiar with and perhaps read, I don't remember now if you actually remark about it in the book or not, is Jim Bishop's book called FDR's Last Year.
Right.
Which on the back cover, this book really has no photographs whatsoever, except on the back cover. There are four photographs. The first, November 1943, of FDR at Tehran, and then three photographs after that that take us in sort of equal installments through to March of 1945, just before he died.
Right.
And the decline is drastic. And that right there, in a nutshell, kind of encapsulates much of what you explore in The Hidden Campaign.
I did read Bishop's book, and I remember asking Dr. Brune about this. Brune is quoted in that book as well. Frankly, he was, as I recall, somewhat disparaging about the accuracy of the quotations. He has, as I recall, Bishop's book. It's been some time since I've read it. But he has FDR saying a variety of things that are a little bit out of character, some self-pitying remarks, some remarks expressing futility of going on, possibly intimations of his own mortality, which Dr. Brune at no time had heard, nor really did anybody else. And indeed, in FDR's own planning, he was very forward-looking at the moment of his death. Within the hour of the death, he was planning his Jefferson Day address for the next day, which was the 13th. Then to return to Washington, and from Washington to travel by rail to San Francisco for the opening of the UN. He then had further specific plans to visit Great Britain, to be a guest of their majesties, possibly to address the parliament, and so on. so that he clearly was thinking in a very forward direction pragmatically. He was not anticipating mortality. So there are a number of things in Bishop's book, which is well-written, very interesting book. Nonetheless, I would really doubt the accuracy of it.
Right. Well, he is, of course, the author of The Day Lincoln Was Shot and The Day Christ Died. And
right.
Those are both examples of works that fill in the gaps sometimes with the writer's imagination. He would probably be the first to.
I think that's a good way of putting it.
You're right. The other book that I wanted to mention, which I do know that you specifically cite at several points, is one of the best books I think I have ever read about an American president. Hugh Gallagher's book, FDR, Splendid Deception.
And I interviewed Gallagher.
Really? I think a lot of us, as we first saw that book on the library shelf or in the bookstore, figured that it was maybe a book about espionage or behind-the-scenes political maneuvering or the covering up of scandal or whatever.
Right.
But, of course, FDR, Splendid Deception refers to the fact that, to a remarkable extent, FDR's situation as a victim of polio was basically off the map in terms of being discussed by the press or even in public. It is amazing to the degree that people seem to be unaware of just how debilitated his condition was.
Well, Greg, I have a problem with that. I interviewed Mr. Gallagher, who himself is a polio patient, and you may have seen the public broadcasting a TV series about FDR and was aired rather recently, at least here in the Northeast. And it's obvious, without probing into Mr. Gallagher's own medical problems, that he clearly was severely afflicted with polio. And he, too, has had an amazing career, and he was just a delightful person to speak to, and I appreciate the time that he had given me. However, I do have two problems with that. He talks about FDR as being clinically depressed, and I'm not sure, even after interviewing Mr. Gallagher, what the basis for that was. There is a tendency with many presidents and presidential candidates to get into all sorts of pseudo-psychiatric analyses, and I don't deny that anybody afflicted as FDR was would have some sort of situational depression, but I don't think that was part of his makeup other than transitorily. As far as Splendid Deception is concerned, though, I do differ. As a child, I was well aware of the fact that FDR was a polio patient. Every January 30th, his birthday, we'd be asked to contribute to the March of Dimes, which was to benefit the Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. And he, of course, was the premier patient with this. Every polio season, late August through Labor Day, we were told, don't go swimming, movies would be closed, camps closed, and so on. And everybody would underline this by saying, well, look, the president had a polio, and if the president could have polio, why? You, as an 8- or a 10-year-old, obviously were, to say the least, equally, if not more, vulnerable. There's clearly no epidemiological link between an individual who was afflicted in 1921 and the events of 2 decades later. But still, in people's minds, that was yet another identification. And finally, every Thanksgiving, he would go down to Warm Springs, which is where he ultimately died, but in any case, would go down there, and he'd be seen having Thanksgiving dinner with a group of children, all of whom were in wheelchairs. So indeed, it was known. Time magazine, during the campaign that I refer to, and I go into this in detail, every single week from Labor Day to Election Day specifically discusses the wheelchair, whether he was standing, seated, what his body posture was. In his obituary notices, there's extensive discussion of the polio. When Winston Churchill eulogized him, he placed great emphasis on FDR's extraordinary courage, intellectual and personal courage, and being able to overcome polio and rebound into positions of extraordinary responsibility. And you may remember Churchill said things like, not one man in 10 million, and so on. So I think that it was very much in the public mind. I agree with Gallagher that specific clinical details, no. We did not have his muscle chart, which Gallagher does publish, available, nor need we have had this. I think any informed individual from a 5-year-old on up was aware of this. He's right. They did not understand the magnitude of this. And numerous references by visitors to him when he was governor and president, all comment, well, gee, I didn't know he was that severely afflicted. I think he handled it in a very debonair way, very matter-of-fact way. He very rarely referred to it. I think one of the problems with the movie Pearl Harbor, in which there's a scene which the actor depicting FDR specifically refers to his paralysis and I think actually shows off his braces and so forth, that's totally out of character.
Right.
For him.
That the topic was kind of off the map as far as FDR was concerned, it seems.
Very, very rarely would he refer to it. His very last speech, March 1, 1945, his final address, an extremely important address, because unlike Wilson, he reported back to the American people. He was bipartisan. He brought the Congress into the planning for the post-war world, specifically the United Nations. He starts out by saying, I hope you will pardon me for the very unusual posture of being seated while addressing you, but it makes it much easier for me than having to carry about the bottom of my legs 15 pounds of steel, and because I've just completed a 15,000-mile journey, and it's greeted with rousing bipartisan applause. It's done with grace, a typical Rooseveltian flair, not self-pitying, just very, very matter-of-fact. And he, by the way, in that speech, he handles the health issue, which you alluded to very well. He says, you know, there were these rumors that I was terribly ill when I was overseas. He said, actually, I felt fine when I was overseas. It was when I got back here that I didn't feel well. And he was referring to one of the marital difficulties of one of his children, which was then front page news. And it was sort of an insider joke, but the Congress laughed appreciatively. And this was typical FDR irony. He obviously was ill, by the way, when he was at Yalta, and that's described in the book. I don't think it had any material effect on the outcome.
I think one of the things that Mr. Gallagher would say, and I think you're probably right, that he overstates the public's ignorance of the fact that FDR had polio. Maybe they were ignorant of its severity. He, I think, is taking to task historians who discuss FDR and who make so little, if any, reference to the fact that he was a victim of polio, as though that was not an important element in FDR's makeup as a human being and as the way that he carried on his life. Just the fact that it often is worthy of a brief mention and not much more.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. This was truly the major life-transforming event. He did not acquire the poliomyelitis until he was 39 years of age, namely on August the 10th of 21. And at that point, his career trajectory was primarily an upward trajectory. There were some clouds on the horizon, which I go into in the book, as did Jeffrey Ward, and I really adapt Jeffrey Ward's description of some of FDR's political problems, as well as his marital difficulties at that point. Nonetheless, on paper at least, his career was described as an upward arc. He was a state senator, a deputy cabinet officer, and then a vice presidential candidate, all at a very, very young age. At a personal level, he was a dancer, golf player, tennis player, very athletic individual. And so the paralysis, which of course would be devastating to anybody, was especially devastating for him. And he had about a 7 or 8 year hiatus, although he was busy with law practices and private investments and so on. But he was devoted primarily to his recovery. Undoubtedly, it had an enormous impact on his thinking, on his understanding of the human condition. Although I think throughout he was a pragmatic political leader, and much of what he would have done, he probably would have done anyway. But I think it made him an empiricist. It made him a person who went beyond rigid dogmas of the past and was willing to explore within the limits of political reality possibilities for the future, as he did in his physical recovery. He had advocated all kinds of exercise programs. He developed a crutch, which apparently is still used, the muscle chart, which Mr. Gallagher shows apparently was adapted by FDR. So he was very much an identifier with the disease, and he took on a medical role. He referred to himself as Dr. New Deal, Dr. Win the War, and specifically the former was an internist, and the latter was an orthopedic surgeon. And obviously his choice of orthopedics would be particularly germane. When he toured the Army hospitals or the military hospitals, he always asked to go to the orthopedic ward because obviously there are people there who had lost limbs, specifically lower extremities, and he would be wheeled in order to emphasize the identification with them. In his final inaugural, there was a very poignant photograph of a military officer shot from the back, and obviously he's lost a limb. You see the trouser leg is pinned up, and you see FDR on the other side of this, and there's a clear-cut analogy between the soldier and FDR. So I think that the polio itself, although that's not the basis for his death, and it was not the cover-up that I'm referring to, the polio itself was a really central feature in his life.
We're talking today on the morning show with Dr. Hugh Evans, the author of a book entitled The Hidden Campaign, FDR's Health and the 1944 Election. Dr. Evans, one of the places you begin in telling this story as preamble to the specific events of 1944 and 45 is that you lay out for us some of the details or information that we know about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's health well before becoming president in 1933. We've already touched on the moment when he is stricken with poliomyelitis in 1921. You actually sketch for us kind of an interesting picture that in some ways seems almost a bit contradictory, in that we're told on the one hand that FDR was an active man, and yet you also tell us something about how his health was never particularly robust, that there was a little bit of a propensity there for physical ailments of one kind or another, even as he was a strapping young man.
Well, yes, but none of those were life-threatening, nor were they even seriously disabling in any way. He did have recurrent bouts of bronchitis, upper respiratory tract infections. I don't get to mention it in the book, but his very first letter to his mother, he's only about six at the time, describes in detail his sniffles and coughing and whatnot with a cold. And his mother would later say, and she was now referring to her son, the president, Franklin has to be babied a lot when he has these colds. But I think that this was a convenient excuse when the moment of truth emerged in the 44 campaign and in the spring of 44, because the official line was, well, he's 4 years older and he does have bronchitis. And he was well known to be a patient with bronchitis. Indeed, his physician was an ear, nose, and throat specialist who probably did not understand fully the significance of the hypertension, which was the underlying problem leading to his congestive heart failure in March, belatedly diagnosed in March of 44, and then on to his death on April 12, 45. But throughout his lifetime, he did have colds, bronchitis. He did have the usual childhood afflictions, but somewhat later than most children would, because he was raised as a solitary child in this enormous mansion. He was not exposed to most of the childhood illnesses at a time that others would be. He didn't leave home until he was about 14. There were governesses and tutors and so forth who were brought in, and he's very well educated, but at home with this. And he did have scarlet fever and measles and so forth, which were typical of that era, but nothing that was life-threatening or disabling. I did try to find his infirmary records. I was a guest speaker at Harvard, and unfortunately they're destroyed after 80 years, and he was an old four graduate of Harvard, so that 80-year interval has gone by.
So you didn't miss it by much, but...
Well, but they didn't preserve it. And in the meantime, though, if you look at his Harvard record, and he was the editor of the school newspaper, apparently he was quite active, and there's no indication at that time, nor in his subsequent law school days. And he was in private practice for 3 years, then on to the state legislature, and I sketched his... pre-polio activities, and at no time was he really seriously ill, except when he returned from the battlefield in 1918 as the highest-ranking civilian government official to visit the war zone. And he did contract influenza and bilateral pneumonia, called double pneumonia, coming back. Some of his shipmates died, actually, and this was part of the influenza pandemic that has a great deal of medical significance in its own right. I would say that was probably one of the few really serious illnesses, along with appendicitis, and that was a major problem in 1915. He had an appendectomy. He also had a tonsillectomy in about 1920 or so, but that was related to his upper respiratory tract infections. Yes, and in a sense, he did have some of these illnesses, but so did others. Influenza was a worldwide pandemic. He's not unusual he was not an unusual patient in that respect. I want to stress, however, that really none of these, as Matt has turned out, were life-threatening nor disabling other than in an acute short-term sense. But they provided him and his physicians with a wonderful rationalization for the coughing and the occasional low-grade fevers and perhaps not being seen in public apart from military necessity.
It gave them a card to play in a sense.
Well, and it was one that the public was used to. And he himself made mention of this when the diagnosis of congestive heart failure was made. He brushed this off. I don't think it was given to him. But he just said, well, this is bronchitis, and they're worried about whether it's going to become pneumonia or not, and there's only a 1 in 10,000 chance that that will happen. And this was all a blind loop that had absolutely nothing to do with the underlying reality that he was now receiving digitalis. And I describe in the book many of the clinical signs of congestive heart failure belatedly diagnosed because he did not get to see a cardiologist until March 28th of 44, and he was obviously ailing for several weeks before that.
FDR, of course, contracts polio in 1921. You tell us something about that. And I think one of the most chilling things in this particular chapter is you give us at least a couple of excerpts from letters from FDR in the late teens when he makes mention of rampant polio. And I think in one case, one letter, he's maybe suggesting that some relatives maybe not come to visit because there just seems to be polio everywhere. And it's just chilling to read those words, knowing that he has no way of knowing at that moment in time that polio is going to become a part of his life. And you mention also that he contracts polio at a rather atypical point in life. If I'm not mistaken, he was older than a typical polio victim.
Oh, yes. And he refers to this with typical humor. He said, I'm a little bit long in the tooth to have infantile paralysis. He was 39. He was actually a patient at the Children's Hospital at Harvard, an outpatient. They did not have facilities for each age range. He was in the older 5 to 10% of individuals who contracted polio. So he certainly wasn't the oldest person in history, but he was among the older ones to have acquired this. And I speculate that perhaps his solitary upbringing in this rarefied stratum might have epidemiologically and demographically predisposed him and people like him to polio, where children who were raised in crowded urban environments would have had a natural immunity. Most polio infection is asymptomatic. That is, there are no signs of it. It's just simply carried from person to person. And then there's a group that has mild gastroenteritis, vomiting, and diarrhea. And then after that, there are relatively few who actually have the neurological manifestations. And clearly he was in that category. Now, we don't know that for certainty, but it seems to make sense epidemiologically. I see your first point, yes. And in the book, I point out he calls infantile paralysis I period, P period, IP. And that's one of the ways he dealt with very serious issues, is to try to make a pun of things or to give a humorous reference to something as a way of diffusing the tensions. And as you state, he does give a very clear picture of the epidemiology, and this was in 1916, which was a major year for polio, and not every year was identical in the magnitude of the epidemic, but 16 was a major year. And he importunes his wife, who he refers to as dearest Babs, to keep the children and the household staff and everybody out of harm's way, and he describes various towns in New England where polio does seem to have emerged and others where it did not. Obviously, there is an irony in all of this because he would become a polio patient himself some 5 years later, but who could have known it at that time?
We, of course, should move on from polio to the sort of essential heart of your book, but I do want to make mention of a quote of FDR's son, Elliot, which I had not read before until your book, in which he is quoted as saying, "Life as a cripple intensified all the characteristics shown in his," meaning FDR's, "letters prior to 1922. His stability became more stable, his optimism more optimistic, and notwithstanding his inability to walk, even his independent nature was intensified.
Well, I think that the point that in that quotation, we've seen others like it, is that there's a compensatory development of other senses. If a person is unable to hear, they may develop greater visual acuity and vice versa. I think with FDR, it's hard to separate the pragmatic from the more philosophical, because clearly he was a very pragmatic, realistic political leader. He knew how to count the votes, as any successful political leader must do. And I think he would have done that anyway. But he did seem to develop that warmth and that empathy. And in fact, there's another quote, it's not in the book, it's been done elsewhere. Mrs. Roosevelt was asked rather tactlessly, do you think that the poliomyelitis affected your husband, he was alive at the time, your husband's mind? And it's rather, say the least, a nasty question. She, in characteristic fashion, parried this by saying, yes, it made him much more empathetic and much more concerned about the well-being of other people. And that's very much in line with what his son Elliot is quoted as saying. He certainly would have had this understanding. And again, he spent so much time in convalescent centers. Indeed, he created the model convalescent center and in Meriwether County, Georgia, namely at Warm Springs, that he would have a necessity had to emerge from this as quite a different person. Both for medical reasons and as well, I do want to stress, pragmatic political reasons were very important, too.
We're talking to Dr. Hugh Evans, the author of The Hidden Campaign, FDR's Health in the 1944 Election. Dr. Evans, you say in the book that that when FDR is stricken with polio, it essentially forces a seven-year hiatus in FDR's political career, but he manages a stirring comeback and is eventually, of course, elected governor of New York City, and then in 1932, elected president of the United States. You talk about the presidential years, the first decade, and give us some sense of FDR's health, which by and large was fairly good, correct?
Well, yes and no. As far as his physical appearance is concerned, he looked to be vibrant, buoyant. He did not have the careworn, haggard look, which you've already alluded to using Bishop's photograph, but there are other documentation. There's other documentation as well. However, almost every year or two, there would be a rumor that would spread throughout the country that FDR was very, very seriously ill, that he was hospitalized, and he might be hospitalized at the Mayo Clinic. He incidentally visited his son there. He himself was not a patient. That he had either psychiatric disturbance or he had a malignancy that had metastasized or heaven only knows what else. And then he would survive that rumor intact and in pretty good health insofar as the alleged grave illness was concerned. So the public, in a way, was immunized because rumor after rumor would sweep the country. It wasn't true. And when, in fact, it was the other way around, when there really was grave and indeed mortal illness, it was denied.
You marked the Tehran conference in late 1943 as something of a benchmark,
right,
in that after he returns from that, there seems to be a marked elevation of concern about FDR's health.
Absolutely.
Those in his inner circle begin to see at least subtle changes in his persona, in the level of his vigor, and so
no
on.
No question that there was a major quantitative reduction, and I use the number of appointments per day as an index of his overall health, and I picked the month of March, and I walk you through each month from 33 right on through to 45, which is his last full month, and show you that in 44 we have a low point, and in fact there's a two-week interval in which he has, in effect, no appointments while in residence. in the White House. That is unprecedented. I've reviewed his appointment record from his first inaugural right on through, and there is no comparable interval while he's in the White House in which he has no official appointments, maybe one or two exceptions. It's not clear that he actually saw those people. His staff assistants may have seen them. And he's seen by a young New Dealer, Mr. Aubrey Williams, who FDR was trying to persuade to come back into federal service. This is one of the few appointments that FDR actually did have. Williams is quoted in the Atlanta Constitution as saying, "I've never seen FDR so haggard, so tired, so worn out." Of course, he's not going to run for office again. He's much, much too tired for this. That was covered in the Atlanta Constitution. It's reprinted in the Times on, I think, page 26 or something of this kind, and really was not given front page attention. Nobody really took up the issues that, perhaps unbeknownst to him, Mr. Williams, Administrator Williams, was raising. The secretaries were very concerned. He apparently would not dictate as frequently as he previously had done. He might even nod off a little bit, atypically in the midst of dictation, then, of course, recover and complete this. His daughter was in residence. The four sons were in uniform in combat zones all over the world. But his daughter, who was the oldest of the five children, was in residence. And she was very concerned about her father's deterioration and importuned Dr. McIntyre, his official physician, and you know, some throat specialist, to have FDR undergo a general checkup, which McIntyre, by the way, insisted to the press FDR had always had an annual checkup, head-to-toe equivalent to that of any naval officer, including McIntyre himself, who was a vice admiral. There's no documentation that I could find of such, but the medical records did disappear. And Dr. Bruin seemed to be a little uncertain as to whether these, in fact, had been conducted. Finally, matters reached a head, and Anna insisted that the problem was more than the sinusitis and the bronchitis, which you had asked about earlier, and something more serious was happening. And on a Tuesday morning, Dr. Bruin, who was in charge of the cardiology department, or at least the EKG department of Bethesda Naval, he was a lieutenant commander, and a well-trained internist cardiologist himself, I think in his late 30s at that point, received a call from the Surgeon General that he was sending him a new patient, namely FDR. And Dr. Bruin, who seems to be very, very unflappable, said, "Well, let me have his medical record." It's not clear that the medical record came along with him. To his surprise, he found FDR in a state of very advanced congestive heart failure, which had not been diagnosed before. And I asked Dr. Bruin, "Well, when did this start?" It didn't start on March 27th, obviously. So, oh, no, no. I said, "Could it have gone back to Cairo, Tehran, late November, early December?" 43 says, "No, that's too far." He said, "Well, what about mid-January when FDR, for the first time in his presidency, did not address the nation and the Congress and the State of the Union?" He had done so in 43 and all preceding January. He said, "Yes, it's possible at that time." When the official explanation was the bronchitis that again, you've mentioned, clearly in Dr. Bruin's mind as a very experienced cardiologist, perhaps this was the beginning of the congestive heart failure. But as I say, diagnosis was not achieved until about 2 months, a little more than 2 months, had gone by.
We have kind of a sense in your book of these two doctors very much at odds, that is Dr. McIntyre and Dr. Bruin. Dr. Bruin discovering alarming deterioration, but Dr. McIntyre consistently giving to the press only the most sort of positive light of FDR's health. What is your sense of Dr. McIntyre's motivation? I mean, was he blind to the information, or was he well aware of the deterioration but simply spreading misinformation, or is it possible that he was misunderstanding the situation and the severity of FDR's physical decline?
It's hard to say because even after FDR died, McIntyre maintained the party line that this was a sudden, unexpected event. He writes a book called White House Physician a year and a half later, and so states, completely glossing over the enormous elevation in blood pressure. Under the current NIH standards, this would have been considered very severe. That is the worst and gravest situation with respect to the magnitude of the hypertension. He glosses over that a year and a half or two later. I think that you have to understand that this was more a military matter than a medical matter. I asked Dr. Bruin whether he felt there was a dichotomy, a gap between his role as Lieutenant Commander Bruin, wearing his nation's uniform, the Navy uniform, in the midst of this global pervasive struggle, which I described in response to your first question, and that of Howard Bruin, MD, internist, cardiologist, background at Columbia Hopkins, a background which he and I shared, although with different generations in different fields, Columbia College as well. And he said, yes, there was a gap. I was much happier as Lieutenant Commander Bruin, which I think was his way of saying he really had to go along with it. He was sworn to secrecy by the FBI, just verbally. There was no written statement. Plus, as he said commonsensically, he never spoke up independently of McIntyre. What was McIntyre's role? Well, he, first of all, medically was an ear, nose, and throat specialist, which did not, you know, necessarily mean that he would not understand general medical problems. He was also a political advisor. When Life magazine listed FDR's 10 most important deputies and assistants, McIntyre was listed there, not for medical reasons. He had known FDR for many years. He was a protege of Cary Grayson, MD, who was also Admiral Grayson, and who performed the same role with Woodrow Wilson, though I think much more skillfully, frankly, and Grayson was a generalist. In any case, McIntyre's role was that of mouthing the party line, of really reinforcing the illusion that FDR was fine. And as I indicate in the book, there were 10 front-page stories in the Times, some of them just a paragraph or so, some much lengthier, in which McIntyre is quoted as saying he's just fine. He's 4 years older. He has bronchitis. There's enough, you know, wear and tear. And Roosevelt himself would comment on this in one of his campaign addresses. He would say, well, I met you 4 years ago, and I'm 4 years older, and so are you. And some people seem to be surprised by this. And he would sort of approach this in a kind of humorous and ironic fashion. I think that McIntyre was a major component of the cover-up. And Bruin just simply had to go along with it. He really had no choice.
Hmm. One of the things that I think was most striking to me in reading your book was that it never would have occurred to me that FDR's failing health would have been written about and discussed so openly in, for instance, newspaper editorials, and it really was. The issue was clearly out there. So it is not that people were ignoring this. It was cause for grave concern among many observers, and that's something I had not realized until I read your book.
Well, you have to understand the focus started in the summer of 44 when there was just a terrible photograph of him, which I include in the book. And I remember the Charles seeing it, and he really looked dreadful for the first time without any question. He slack-jawed, he seemed glassy-eyed and so forth. Actually, if you listen to the speech, which I have done, the speech is just fine. And his
Which speech is this?
This was brushed off as being, you know, just one bad photograph. But from that point on, there was largely a partisan attack. Obviously, this was done primarily by the Republican press. And I quote the Chicago Tribune, which is an extreme example of that, as being very explicit in forecasting that if you voted Democratic, you'd be voting for Senator Truman to become president of the United States. They come flat out and say this. And Time magazine doesn't say that, but they certainly infer it. Life magazine, in three very detailed and well-reasoned editorials, recommends Governor Dewey, but it really was not health-related. I interviewed Herbert Brownell, who was really the point man in all of this. He was Governor Dewey's campaign manager, later attorney general, very prominent practicing attorney, very capable and sophisticated. And I asked him, why weren't you more explicit about this? And he told me, look, this was the problem. We're in the midst of World War II. Our opponent was the commander-in-chief, and undoubtedly was the leader of a very successful effort. In fact, Dewey himself said, we're not going to change the military strategy or the military leadership if we win. But what Herbert Brownell pointed out to me, he said, suppose we were wrong. suppose in spite of the absolutely dreadful appearance of FDR, he really was not mortally ill. He did not have any underlying disease. There's no way of looking at anybody and knowing what their blood pressure is. That kind of error could have boomeranged against us for a generation or more. It's not the type of error that you can really countenance. We really had to know. The campaign was split on this. Some people thought that Governor Dewey should be much more explicit about this. Others felt this was much too dangerous an approach. And interestingly, once he's reelected, all that talk evaporates. There is no longer any talk from Election Day through the inauguration, through the actual moment of his death, that, my goodness, he could die at any minute. There was very little to suggest this. By the way, when he was inaugurated for the fourth time, his comment to the press corps is, by the way, the first 12 years are the most difficult. And we all broke up in laughter. And there's another quote where Frank Kent, who represented the Baltimore Sun in those days, and I think goes on to the Herald Tribune, who clearly has a Republican perspective, congratulates FDR on his reelection, and says, by the way, Mr. President, would you share with us your thoughts about a fifth term? And the room erupted in laughter. And in no way was there any thought that this was a medical impossibility, which in fact was true.
Right. One of the things I want to ask you about is your sense of what should have been done differently. And I think you're going to have probably a couple of different responses to that. First of all, I wonder if you have a sense or an opinion that you care to share on whether or not FDR had any business running for that fourth term. I mean, I get a sense from your book that he felt compelled to do so, despite the fact that his health was in such an alarming decline. What would you have had him do had you been in a position to advise him?
I think that the basic decision for a wartime commander-in-chief, with the outcome still not certain, fighting a very well-equipped foe, with an enormous war machine on the other side, our victories notwithstanding, with the enormous mortality, by the way, if you look at page 2 and 3 of the Times, as I did for this, and I quote Dr. Bruin's response to this, every single day, there would be announcement of deaths. And unlike Vietnam, this was a military activity that brought in people in all ranks of and all walks of life. It was not just one group or another group of people that were involved. And I stressed at the outset, this war was the war. It was totally different from Vietnam or any of the subsequent struggles, with due respect to the valor of those who fought in them. I think the fundamental decision, only because of the war, was probably correct. And I would quote Douglas MacArthur II, self-described as a conservative Republican, that every day we had the same commander-in-chief, his differences with FDR notwithstanding. But we had that continuity was a plus for us. Indeed, when he did die, many people stopped and thought, well, what will this mean for the military leadership? What will this mean for our policies? Fortunately, Truman stepped into the breach very quickly, and there was no problem, but there could have been.
Right.
So I think that decision was correct, but there were two modifiers. One is there should have been a contingency plan. Truman was selected as vice president, I think largely for pragmatic political reasons, and it turns out to have been probably an inspired choice. He was a self-generated scholar. He knew a great deal. He really rose to the occasion, but I think he should have been better prepared.
Right.
So there should have been a contingency plan. There's one more invidious problem. Suppose FDR didn't die, but suppose he had a Wilson-type stroke. I think it would have been a real disaster for the nation, as it was when Wilson did have the stroke, but at least the war was over, to have the war continue and have a disabled president. Some contingency planning would have to have been in place for Truman to have stepped in as an acting president. Given, however, the constitutional realities of that era, the culture and climate of that era, and vice presidents were really very peripheral until perhaps Mondale, or even Nixon with Eisenhower was certainly much more central. But in that era, across party lines, vice presidents simply presided over the Senate and went to ceremonial occasions. There really was not a major work assignment for them, except episodically. All in all, to answer your question, only because of the context and only because of the unique circumstances, I would think that the decision was correct with the two modifiers
right.
that I brought in. However, I think we're most unlikely to have that set of contingencies again, and I would not want to extrapolate from 1944 to any subsequent election.
A final question. The campaign, if we want to call it that, to hide FDR's alarming physical decline, to what extent did that contribute to his death? I'm trying to understand this because you give us a sense that in fact he was mortally ill. And so, at least given the technology of the day, there really was no help, no realistic hope for him to recover once this decline had begun. But was there any sense in which hiding the truth or the severity of his situation compromised the kind of care which he received?
Oh, it's more than that. I think that the worst possible occupation that one could have had superimposed on the medical realities was that of being a wartime president of the United States, regardless of party or whether he did or did not have polio or anything else. Clearly, his treatment was woefully substandard from a purely medical point of view. As I said at the outset, this was not a medical issue, it was a military issue. When I asked Dr. Bruin, I said, how many other patients have you had, given that degree of congestive failure, who you treated at home? He said none, and he had many patients. He had a very significant referral practice in Manhattan for decades. Undoubtedly had seen, and he indicated to me, had seen other patients with a congestive heart failure, probably a little less severe than FDR's. They would be hospitalized immediately. Indeed, any patient walking into an emergency room right now, at any age, man or woman, with this level of blood pressure would probably be hospitalized, perhaps put in an intensive care unit, but in any case, would not be permitted to just go about their business. FDR should have been either hospitalized or have a hospital equivalent. This was not possible. There were other modalities of therapy besides digitalis that could have been given, mercurials with ammonium chloride. There was very special diets that were used. There were isothiocyanate. There was a surgical procedure. Granted, none of them have the sophistication except the digitalis, perhaps the mercurial diuretics, although that's since been superseded with what we have today. But even given the spectrum of therapeutic agents that were available, the goal was just simply keep him going with the least possible amount of intrusiveness into his responsibilities as wartime commander-in-chief. And yes, there was a sacrificial component to this. From a purely medical point of view, I think in a totally different context, he obviously should not have run for president and perhaps should have even turned the reins over to somebody. But unfortunately, Henry Wallace, who was his vice president, had created a great deal of difficulty for himself. So the purely medical answer to your question is one thing, and it's pretty straightforward and almost reflexive. But given that context and given the subtleties and the complications because of the war, I think in general what was done was correct, once again, with those two or more modifiers.
The book is The Hidden Campaign, FDR's Health in the 1944 Election. Its author, Hugh Evans, our guest today on The Morning Show. Dr. Evans, a real pleasure to speak with you, and I commend you for writing a really fascinating book, which I'm sure will continue to generate great discussion. I thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed being here.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Dr. Art Sear pays his monthly visit to the program to talk about a number of different issues and concerns, including, of course, the dramatic recent events in